Well, greetings. This is Joe Farinaccio from OutRigMedia.com and SmallTrimarans.com. And I've got Jim Brown here on the phone today. We wanted to send you some holiday greetings, as well as talk with Jim about some multi-hull news and find out what's going on with Jim. How are you today, Jim?
Hello there, Joe, and Merry Christmas to everybody.
Wow, that's great. I know that you got at least one project going on, plus you just came back from Florida, and we thought this would be kind of a fun podcast to release here as we get ready for the holiday season here in 2016.
Yeah, I have a little news, Joe. I thought the listeners might like to know that I had a chance to travel for the last month or so. I started by going down to I live in Virginia, you know, southern Virginia, and I went down to Greensboro, North Carolina, which is where Andy Zimmerman lives and has his product development company. I've worked with Andy before. He's the guy that commissioned me to do the Wind Riders. And we're working on another project now together. It's really great to be doing it with Andy, because he reminded me, years ago when we started working together, he reminded me so much of California, because he was fearless. He did not consider the possibility of failure in his manufacturing operation. He's a guy who has maybe built something like a million boats by running his paddle sports companies, Wilderness Systems, and then eventually Confluence Corporation, which he has since sold, but is now the largest paddle sports manufacturer in the world. And I'm not ready to tell you about what we're working on. It's kind of a secret, and I think that you'll be surprised. It's an entirely different kind of boat. But I spent a couple of days there with Andy and his two engineers, Ken and Terry. We had a good time talking about the project. And then Andy and I got into his Sprinter van, towing the Wind Rider 17, and we went off to Cedar Key, which is a sleepy little resort town on the west coast of Florida. It is the site of the annual Cedar Key small boat event, and I thought the listeners might like to know that we are now holding two events per year. For the past 32 years or 33 years, it's been only once a year. The first full weekend in May is when it happens. This year, for the first time, we tried an event just before Thanksgiving, the weekend before Thanksgiving. And it worked out great. We had about half as many as the usual participants, but there were still plenty of boats and plenty of people and plenty of time for schmoozing about boats. It's a very low-key event, confined pretty much to trailerable and car-toppable boats, some of which are multi-hulls. We had three Wind Riders there this fall and had a great time sailing around. And mostly it's, you know, let's talk about boats, and we did a lot of that. And after the Cedar Key weekend, I joined up with Bruce Matlack, and Bruce is my old friend who is an old windsurfing champion, and he has a Wind Rider 17 and a motorhome. And so we rolled in his motorhome on down to a secret location that's somewhere in Florida. We're not going to tell you where it is because we don't want it to get ruined. This is a really amazing boatyard. It has a very jungle setting. It's sort of in the Everglades. And it has a little creek that leads up from a big river and a nice wide launching ramp so that they can handle multi-hulls, big cruising multi-hulls. And it has become known as the place where all the old sailboats go to die.
Okay.
And there are some boats there that are crumbling and some boats there that are excellent, including several Sea Runner trimarans. My Sea Runner cruising trimaran designs are well represented there, including Scrimshaw, my old boat, which I built in California back in the late 60s, and we sailed for 40 years. Joanna and I did all of our family sailing in that boat. And as I may have explained in a previous podcast, the boat was sold about 4 years ago to a guy who never used it. And then Bruce Matlack came along and bought it. So it has been hauled out there at this secret boatyard in Central Florida, where Bruce and his friend Danny have been bringing her up. She's beginning to look brand new again, and she's about ready for a hop down to the Florida Keys and then across to the Bahamas this winter. Bruce intends to take her over to the Bahamas, and who knows where from there. He's been thinking about, you know, the Rio Dulce, Cuba, Yucatan, no telling, but I just wanted the listeners to know that she's definitely being restored, you know, rescued from her 3 years of idleness under the previous owner. And she's headed for sea again.
Wow, that's wonderful. So I guess the boat is structurally sound, right?
Yes. Uh-huh. We did find one spot that needed a little attention because of a rainwater leak through the deck and through a fitting on deck. And so there's a lot to be said about maintenance of an old wooden boat, particularly a plywood cruising multi-hull, which they're so lightly built that there's no room for decomposition. They really have to be maintained carefully and well ventilated. The very worst thing, of course, Joe, is water standing in the bilge.
Right.
What happens if the boat is leaking rainwater through the deck or seawater through the bottom? That water evaporates, and particularly if the boat is being kept in the tropics like this one, the evaporation is the problem. That is, it creates a humid atmosphere in the boat. And even if the boat is epoxy-coated entirely on the inside, it's possible for the terrarium effect to affect the structure, to attack the structure. In our case, it was a leak through a fitting, actually in the cabin side. And we had to get in there and investigate. It involved taking off some of the A-frame mount and checking out the condition of the wood. Turned out that everything was okay, and we slathered it up with epoxy and put it back together, and I'm sure it's fine. But it does take assiduous attention to watertight decks, hatches, windows, fittings, and watertight bottoms, no dripping shaft logs and stuff like that. The boat must be maintained in a dry condition. That was Jan Gujon's wisdom from many years ago. Tell me what's wrong with wood, Jan. His answer was, you got to keep it dry.
Yeah, yeah. And John Marples always stresses ventilation as well.
Yeah, Well, I should tell you a little bit more about this secret location. The guy that runs it is a wonderful old character named Wayne Brown, and he's not just a boatyard proprietor. He's also an artist. In order to clear the land for his operation, he got himself a great big backhoe, and he had to move big piles of coral rock, and he didn't just move them. He piled them up, but took special care in piling them up, and they all turn out to be sculptures. Very abstract, but very beautiful sculptures with a rock garden effect, all kinds of tropical vegetation growing up around and through these rock piles. It also has a beautiful swimming pool, so that after a long hot day working in a grimy boatyard, you could go jump in a pool. And
that sounds like my kind of boatyard, Jim.
Yeah, and the people there are people there living on their boats and working on their boats, and it's a really a fabulous crowd. Some of those folks have done a lot more sailing than I have, I'll tell you. And it's a lot of information exchange in a situation like that. So after Cedar Key, I came on home here and found that I had used up my store of caper casts. I had prepared several in advance, and when we got home, we had almost used them up by my absence. And so we are doing this program today because we haven't got a program of the usual sort to post just before Christmas. And we wanted to say happy holidays to you all. And another thing about the secret boatyard is that they have a special fauna there, too, alligators on the dock. They keep their distance, but the proprietor says, "Oh well, I just wouldn't go swimming around here if I were you."
Okay.
So anyway, Scrimshaw sails again soon. Our last installation, at last production for the podcast, was about proa. The last two have been on the subject of the single outrigger proa configuration, and we had a lot of nice response to those programs, right, Joe?
Yeah, a lot. They seem to have struck a nerve in the guys who are very interested in proas that are on your podcast listeners list.
Well, the proa people are adamant. There's something about the proa that grabs the sailor's mind in a way that is not found in the boats of Eurocentric design. The proa has this incredible feature of being required to sail either end first. It has a bow on both ends, as I've explained previously, and it has to retain its single outrigger. It's like a trimaran with one float missing, except that the one float you've got is farther out there. They have extreme beam, and the outrigger hull has to be kept constantly to windward, that is, facing the wind, except, of course, in the case of the Newark. Dick Newick designed early proas, the so-called Atlantic proas, which keep their outrigger on the downwind side. And those boats can be very successful in racing. You can push them harder than the float on the upwind side, the so-called Pacific proa. But as far as I know, every one of the Atlantic proas that has ever been put to sea has been capsized. And it seems to happen when they are left unattended. That is, if the racing sailor goes to sleep and the wind changes or something happens to cause the boat to get caught aback, that is, the wind on the wrong side, the thing tips over. It's not intended for that to receive the wind from the outrigger side. That's the Atlantic proa. But the Pacific proa is intended to receive the wind from the outrigger side, and in order to work its way up toward the wind, that is to beat the windward with a proa, you can be sailing along. Let's say you've got the now bow headed up toward the wind, and you want to tack. Well, you can't tack because that would tend to put the float on the wrong side. So instead, one has to bear off briefly, stop the boat, and move the rig to the other end of the boat. That is, the wind is going to be coming over the other bow now. The what was the then bow becomes the now bow, and off she goes in the other direction, and then you can haul her up on the wind. As a matter of fact, the proas that have been developed by my son Russell, which are the only ones that I have any seafaring experience with, they are remarkably close winded. I tried to explain that last time. It seems that the possibility of improving windward performance is definitely there in the proa, because the mast, at least in my son Russell's proas, the mast is stepped not on the main hull, but to windward of the main hull, on the platform. In fact, just upwind of the cockpit, which is on the windward side of the hull also. And so the mast has to incline slightly downwind, that is, away from the wind, in order for the head stays, there's two head stays from the top of the mast, and they lead down to the ends of the main hull bow, and they lead slightly off downwind of the mast step. And it's that lead that prevents the mast from, if the boat gets caught aback, prevents the mast from falling over toward the float. And so the boat must be handled so as to keep the wind on the correct side, because the rig really isn't strong enough to be driven hard if the wind is coming over the side opposite the float. Well, all of that gets to be pretty complicated, but what I wanted to say was really that we appreciate the response to my proa stories. I'm far from the expert, and my son Russell is very reluctant to participate in a discussion like this. He could tell us a lot more than I can, but he's always been quite reticent to help others develop proas unless they are very experienced seamen. That is, they need to have a lot of sea time in order to understand the problems and to get their mind around a craft that sails either end first and is not bilateral. We're always accustomed to looking at boats, well, looking at each other. We've got a right side and a left side, and they're sort of a mirror image of one another. Well, that's not the case in a proa. If you look a proa in the face, you know, all it has is, let's say, its right eye, its right ear, and its right arm. Whereas if you look at it from the side, particularly from the windward side, it has two ends that are identical. It is bi-ended instead of bilateral. And it takes quite some readjustment of our tacking mindset, our familiarity with bilateral things, in order to come to understand the proa. And yet those who do understand it begin to realize that there's something quite wonderful about it. It's, in my view, it's the most efficient sailing machine ever devised. That is, it has a means of propelling itself through the water by the power of the wind, and the vessel has to receive the wind from only one side, so a lot of duplication is avoided. The downwind side of a monohull sailing vessel really isn't doing much for you. The rigging is slack and so on. It's redundant. Whereas with the proa, everything there is utilized, whether you're going toward the now bow or the then bow. And for that reason, it can be built more inexpensively and lighter than most other sailing configurations. It becomes very attractive to a certain audience who's willing to contend with its problems. It has some significant disadvantages. The boats are not really tactical, Joe. That is, in a race around the buoys, a short race anyway, you might have difficulty with a proa because now and then you have to stop and take off in the other direction.
Right.
And so they are not popular. It's not a popular boat type at present. That's okay. I like to think about it in future terms. I've been fooling with proas a little bit in recent years, and I've done one that I call Sidekick. It's actually, I've done two in the Sidekick name. Each of them was less than 16 feet long, and they were devised to be what I called a sit-down windsurfer, powered by a windsurfer rig, and the pilot sits on a single crossbeam. The two hulls, the main hull and the floater, joined together by only one crossbeam, and that crossbeam can pivot at the hulls so that, in effect, the float can be advanced forward of its normal position on one shunt and then forward of its normal position on the other shunt, too. And in order to do that in a 16-foot boat, the float has to make an excursion out there of about 6 feet. That is, it swings on its crossbeam. It has lines to keep it lined up parallel with the main hull. It's sort of like a pantograph. And this configuration was dreamt up. I think it had been done before, but I wanted to do it to try to make the boat rudderless. Most of the seafaring proas these days, both the Atlantic type and the Pacific type, have two rudders, one for going in each direction. And that means that the rudder that's toward the end of the boat, that is the now bow end, that rudder has to be retracted when going in that direction. It comes up like a dagger board. And in fact, the rudder is a dagger board with a big trim tab on its trailing edge. And it's that trim tab that really steers the boat. So the business of raising and lowering the rudders is pretty easy to do if it's worked out as Russell has done it. That is, it can be controlled by lines from the cockpit, and one simply pulls on one line and releases the other in order to retract one board and drop the other. And so the weight and complication of two rudders, let's call them board rudders, and two trunks, vertical daggerboard type trunks, all of that amounts to a lot of weight, cost, and complication. And my effort has been to try to develop a proa that would steer without rudders. And I got there pretty much in the first boat, the first one that I did, which I think was way back in the very early 2000s. It had a dagger board in the float. And so when the float made this excursion fore and aft, it also moved the dagger board. And moving that dagger board, its position relative to the sail, would cause the boat to steer one way or the other. Wow. So the pilot sits on the single crossbeam with his feet on the main hull, and he kicks it. He sidekicks it. That is, he pushes with one leg on one end of the main hull in order to make the float and crossbeam assembly swing one way or the other. And then he can push with the other leg. And the legs are pretty strong. They can make this happen. And I'll be darned, I was able to get the boat to steer pretty well in every point of sailing except downwind. And I was stumped by that. I put the project aside for a while until fairly recently, just about 4 years ago, I guess, fairly recent. Andy Zimmerman gave me the go-ahead. He said that he would come up with the necessary materials, money, and labor time for us to try to produce this thing as a consumer product. We figured that a lot of the people who enjoy windsurfing were getting older, and maybe they'd like to be able to sit down while they're out there zipping around. So John Marples and I built the second version, which we also called Sidekick, and it was a strip-planked, quite an interesting-looking thing. I tried a few different ideas in its configuration, and by and large, they did not work. They were the boat was not as effective as the original. It looked a lot better, but it was not. I did manage to get it to sail, but I'll tell you, Joe, it was a wild beast. You'd get that thing going, and it would take over, you know. And the windsurfer sail was so balanced as to make it shunt like the main hull, that is, moving, getting the sail to draw toward the now bow, and then stop the boat and draw for the new now bow. That operation occurred sort of automatically, so you could be really romping along and lose track a little bit of which way you were headed and how you were controlling the sheet and so on. And all of a sudden the thing would shunt and take off like a scalded dog in the opposite direction. And you could really get dizzy about which way you were going and where you were going and figuring out what to look for that you might run into. And I was unable to solve that problem without using a steering oar. And because the boat goes in both directions, I had to have two steering oars. And it turned out to be a mishmash, too complicated. We also, for a while, we were trying steering dagger boards and also a steering lee board in the float that would swing toward one end of the float or the other, and it was all operated by the swinging of the crossbeam. And we got the whole thing to work, and it would sail, but it was a mishmash, you know. And so that poor contraption is now down there in one of Andy's warehouses in Greensboro, North Carolina. And because it's strip-planked and varnished and rather attractive, I think it's going to end up hanging from the ceiling in his warehouse as a giant mobile. You know, one that didn't work. I think all it needs is another $10,000 of R&D money, and we could make it work, but I would need help because I'm stumped myself. Anybody who wants to talk about a rudderless proa, I'd be pleased to hear from them. So we've also talked about the proas of the past, the ancient vessels, Joe. We've really gone back into that in podcast number 16. And my experience out in the Pacific Islands, working with people who really live with proas on a work-a-day basis. And I thought I knew something about yacht design until I went out there, and they sure did show me a thing or two. And particularly, what I came to understand is the way their traditional proas are lashed together. The crossbeams are lashed to the main hull, and they protrude out with a sort of a ladder and diagonal lattice work arrangement to brace it as best as they can. But then the float connective to the platform becomes a real challenge. And in olden days, you know, in the ancient proas, it was all done with lashings. And the lashings were very beautifully done. Just incredible things that I refer to as textile art. But it's not like stainless steel and fiberglass and carbon fiber, you know. The real problem is trying to hold that outrigger on there. And in the trimaran, the ancient trimarans or bancas, when they had a float on both sides, it was the lashings on the downwind side when going to windward. Of course, the downwind trimarans float, or double outrigger canoes float. Those lashings are subjected to terrible loads, which we can accommodate these days with our modern materials, but the ancient people just didn't have the stuff that we have today in order to tie things together. And so they simply eliminated the downwind float, and in order to then operate the vessel, they had to be able to make it go either end first. That's the long and the short of it. So that's enough of that, Joe. I realize that we are running over our usual time limit here, and I'm hoping that the listeners will be interested in hearing more of this stuff. We need to know. We need to have feedback. Please let us know, folks, if you want me to speak more about PROAs and more about the future, particularly of boats, but even the future of humankind. I would love to have participation on the podcast, your thoughts. We can talk with you on the phone just like we're Joe and I are talking now and record the conversation. And in the meantime, I hope you have time over the holidays to consider these things and think about how very fortunate we are to live at this time and live where we are and when we are and be who we are. It's a great time to complicate that, contemplate that Freudian slip. So, thank you, Joe. You too. Have a good holiday. We'll try to get another one out during Christmas week. Maybe we can continue with these thoughts, okay?
Thanks, Jim.
Okay, bye-bye.